Jello Morton and his Red Hot Peppers and Grandpa Spells. Louis Armstrong opened that set with Sweethearts on Parade. It's 4 o'clock, and you're tuned to Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Every Saturday evening at 6, from coast to coast in small towns and big cities, public radio listeners tune in to hear the latest news from the small Midwestern town of Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average. Lake Wobegon is the creation of Garrison Keillor, who has made it the setting of his live Saturday night variety show called A Prairie Home Companion. I've heard some people compare the show to the Grand Ole Opry. I've even heard it compared to a church for people who aren't sure what they believe in. The Opry comparison refers to the live music performances on the show. The house band is the Butch Thompson Trio, who plays a blend of jazz and Tin Pan Alley. There are usually two or three guest bands each week, playing either folk music, country, bluegrass, ballads, ethnic musics. The church comparison, by the way, alludes to Garrison's ability to function as a minister who really knows how to deliver a good sermon. But of course, Keillor's parables are all about the people of Lake Wobegon, like Father Emil, the priest of Our Lady of Perpetual Responsibility Church, and Jack, who operates Jack's Auto Repair and Jack's School of Thought. Jack is one of the sponsors of A Prairie Home Companion. The show is actually funded with grants and underwriting, but as far as Keillor's concerned, radio shows ought to have commercials, so he solicited the backing of Lake Wobegon sponsors like Bob's Bank, whose motto is neither a borrower nor a lender be, and Ralph's Pretty Good Grocery, and Ralph says, if we don't have it, you can probably get along without it. But the most faithful sponsor over the years has been Powder Milk Biscuits, the product that gives shy people the nerve to get up and do what has to be done. Garrison Keillor, who comes from a shy background, started the show 7 years ago, Saturday nights, live from the World Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota. It was broadcast through the Minnesota Public Radio Network, but it's been broadcast nationally for, I guess, close to 2 years now since the NPR satellite system went into operation. Keillor's from a small town. He was born in Anoka, Minnesota in 1942, but don't be fooled by all the small-town emphasis. Since 1969, Garrison's humor pieces have appeared in the sophisticated urban magazine The New Yorker. If you listen each Saturday at 6, you know that Keillor recently took the show on the road to Boston, Washington, and Philadelphia. In conjunction with WUHY and Swarthmore College, an edition of Prairie Home Companion was recorded at Clothier Hall in Swarthmore College, and a very enthusiastic Delaware Valley audience was on hand to cheer him on and to sing along with the Powder Milk Biscuit theme. The day before the Swarthmore show, Garrison came to WUHY, where I recorded the interview with him that we're about to hear. If you'd like to hear the Swarthmore edition of A Prairie Home Companion, you can hear it 2 weeks from tonight, that's Saturday, November 14th, from 6 until 8 o'clock here on WUHY. Well, from that Swarthmore appearance, before we hear the interview, let's hear a brief sample of Garrison Keillor and A Prairie Home Companion.
Thank you, young men, and welcome to this next half hour of our show, brought to you by your friends in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, the little town that time forgot that the decades cannot improve, including the Chatterbox Cafe, where Dorothy presides, the place to go that's just like home, where you may not find a fancy menu and fancy decor, but as Dorothy herself says, when it comes to the day where I have to charge 75 cents for a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, just to put a rug on the floor so the people will probably spill on it anyway, that's the day I get out of the business. And also by Skoglund's Five and Dime in Lake Wobegon, where you really do find some things that just cost a nickel. If you're doing entertaining this fall, around the holiday season, you want to stop in at Skoglund's to pick up a fine matching set of tablecloth, 8 placemats, and 8 napkins, all of them plastic, including the napkins, so that you can wipe them off with a damp cloth and use them again and again. They come in several different patterns, including trees, dogs, American presidents, the NFL, rural scenes, and Bible families. And they're all down there at Skoglund's. And a reminder that for your entertaining, you know, it's fine to serve soda pop in a bottle at the table when it's only family present. But when you have guests in, it is much more gracious to serve it in a cut glass goblet available in green, amber, or orange from Skoglund's. A tip from Skoglund's: when you do pour the soda pop at the table, pour it down the side of the goblet so that you don't lose all of the bubbles, and also so that it doesn't all just fizz up and spill all over the tablecloth in case it isn't plastic. You might also remember that you serve a red soda pop with beef or pork and a white one with chicken or fish, and a nice black cherry for dessert, or a grape, and you'll be all set. So stop on down to Skoglund's now if you're having people over this coming weekend.
We'll have more excerpts from A Prairie Home Companion coming up, but first let's begin the interview I recently recorded with Garrison Keillor.
I understand that the idea for Prairie Home Companion had to do with researching something about the Grand Ole Opry.
I was down in Nashville looking at the Grand Ole Opry and trying to write about it the same year that we started this show. But I think that it started back long, long time ago when I was a little boy and we listened to radio at home. I was born in 1942. Television came into our neighborhood in about 1951 and 2. Those sets with the little tiny picture tubes. But we never got one at our house until about 58. My parents held out for religious reasons. And so radio was our only outside source of entertainment. We couldn't go to movies. We didn't go to dances or other things. And for me, radio was it. We had no television.
Did you have a show that you used to do in your bedroom at night?
With the little tube from the tube from the vacuum cleaner, and the little cardboard tube that the paper towels came around. Sure.
What was that show like?
I used to do news shows. I did news shows. I would have the afternoon newspaper in front of me, and I would try to read from it as I heard people read over the radio.
Now, how did they sound where you were? Because, like, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and listening to rock and roll stations, and you had, that was like the home of the fast-talking radio DJs, so... Mm-hmm. Where I was from, when you were imitating radio people, you were talking in rhymes a mile a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So what was your style?
Much slower. Uh-huh. Much slower in the Midwest. Even the rock and roll DJs were not nearly as frenetic as out east.
I've always wondered about that.
And when I was young, see, I'm quite a bit older than you are, and when I was young, people in radio were still friendly and slow-talking, you know, old Uncle Bob. And the lady who read the stories on Storytime, and the newscasters were kind of slow and reassuring about the news.
There's that kind of quality on your show, on the Prairie Home Companion, of it being slow and having this cast of characters who everybody knows, and it's kind of like a family,
mm-hmm.
you know, on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sense of, like, the wholesome turned on its head, maybe, that comes across in your show, and of the small town. And we're in a period now where there's this, like, nostalgia for small town life and a lot of talk about, you know, like, what life used to be. Do you have a nostalgia for the small town or for that kind of wholesomeness? I wonder what all that means to you.
I have a great curiosity about small towns, and especially the small town that I talk about on the radio. I think that I'll never get to the end of it, even if the radio show should end. I don't think I would ever get to the end of Lake Wobegon. I think that I keep on finding out new things about it, and it is a way for me as a writer of finding out new things about my own life and people I knew
years and years ago. But it's not nostalgia. It's not nostalgia. I had a miserable time when I was a teenager, much of it in a small town, and I never want to go back to it. I don't have the slightest doubt in my mind about it. I would never go back to it. I'll never go back to that school. If I walked into that high school that I went to, I would be miserable instantly. And I would never want to go back to it. And I say that without any... Am I saying that without any bitterness?
It's hard to tell.
Is there some bitterness?
Did you have a kind of Peyton Place, small-town upbringing where everybody was nosy and knew everybody's business?
Well, they knew each other. I mean, you couldn't help but know other people's business. It was just the way people lived. I never read Peyton Place, so I'm at a loss there.
Mm-hmm. Your small town, the Lake Wobegon thing, there's like a cast of characters within it and of regular places. And as a writer, you say you'd never reach the end of it. What are some of the trade-offs of having this continuing saga and continuing set of characters that you turn to week after week and whose stories are constantly being developed? Are there pros and cons of having that constant setting?
Well, I can think of the advantages. I would have to think harder to think of the disadvantages. But you see, I believe in limitations as a way of stimulating freedom. And so I would be inclined in any work that I would do, radio or elsewhere, to always pick a pretty small piece of canvas, you know. If I had that whole wall, you know, if I were a painter and had that whole wall, that wall would defeat me. But if I had a postcard, I could do something with that.
Uh-huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, well, that's just how I am. Other people are different.
We're listening to an interview with Garrison Keillor, and all of us who listen to A Prairie Home Companion have wondered why he does commercials on the show. So before he explains that, let's hear from one of his sponsors.
This portion of our show brought to you by the Fearmonger Shop in the Dales. I want to say just a word about them. Most parents, before they turn in for the night, like to make sure that their families are safe and well-protected, and I know a lot of them check to see that the doors are locked and bolted, that the batteries in the smoke detectors are working, that the baseball bats are within arm's reach. And then they go to sleep, most of them unaware that their loved ones are easy prey for the most terrifying danger of all, and I'm talking about deadly snakes. Many people think that deadly snakes can't live in cold climates, and they're partly right, because when it is cold, deadly snakes head for warm places, like homes, for example. Old movie theaters. In the home, the favorite nesting place for deadly snakes, as all of us have known since childhood, is at the foot of the bed under the covers. And here, public awareness is the solution. If every parent would simply whack the bed a few times with a baseball bat before the child crawls into bed, the danger of bed snakes could be completely eliminated. But how do deadly snakes enter the home in the first place? The answer is obvious if you think about it. Our municipal sewer systems are teeming with deadly snakes. Snakes that were once kept as pets until, of course, people found out that they were deadly, so they didn't want them anymore. And then they were flushed down the toilet. And they lived down there in the sewers, but when it's cold, they're looking for a warm place, and what would be more natural than for them to try and get out of the sewer the same way they went in? That's why the Fearmonger's Shop recommends safety seats for every toilet in your home. When closed, safety seats clamp on tight to the toilet bowl, keeping snakes in, even those little hair snakes that can get through little cracks. Then you open it up,
and the safety seat unfolds to become an elevated toilet seat. You sit 36 inches above water level, safely out of reach of even the longest snake, even those chain snakes that stand on each other's shoulders and trying to get at you. So let's give deadly snakes the old 1-2. One, whack that bed with a baseball bat. Get those bed snakes out of there. And secondly, give yourself a safety seat from the Fearmonger's shop, the makers of home defense systems. Remember, where safety is concerned, don't look for savings. Shop at the Fearmonger's shop in the Dales, Mondale, Royandale, Beerendale, Chippendale, Airedale, and all of the other places out there. The Fearmonger's shop.
It's always amazed me that, you know, in public radio, the one place where you don't have to do commercials, as a matter of fact, you're not allowed, you have these wonderful, you know, imaginary commercials that you do. And I've always wondered why you've invented commercials for a public radio broadcast.
I grew up with commercial radio. That's what we listened to in our home. And the sort of show I do, I just always associated with commercials. It wouldn't feel right. See, commercials allow you to stop one thing and to go do something else and then come back to something else. Whereas in most public radio, we have this great long expanse of time available to you. Sometimes you'll stick on something too long, you see. Now, see, if I should get talking too long here and just get real boring and repetitive and tiresome, a commercial would be of a real value to you. See, you'd say, I'm sorry, I've got to stop and go to something else and get rid of me. But I know that this is public radio and I can go on being as boring as I want to be for as long as I want to, almost.
So that, well, then you had to figure out sponsors to have, and I guess your longest-running sponsor is Powder Milk Biscuits?
That's right.
How did you invent them?
All of those old Saturday night jamboree barn dance shows, they always had a sponsor that had something to do with flour. I mean, Martha White Flour has been the long-running sponsor of the Grand Ole Opry, and Gold Medal was with the National Barn Dance and so on, because rural people were still baking, you see, way on up into the 50s and still are today. So I just associated some kind of flour product with that type of show, and I decided I'd pick a biscuit, you know, because I always liked biscuits, especially if you use them to mop up gravy.
I really like the Fearmonger shop dealing and all your phobia needs.
Yeah.
How did that one get generated?
How did that one get started?
This is the kind of shop I would frequent, I think.
Yeah. I think it started with my own fears of snakes and spiders, which make a person especially uncomfortable as you have a child. You see, I have a boy who's 12, and I, of course, a person doesn't want to show fear in front of their children. And so I think that's how my phobias came to my attention, was as the boy grew up.
It came to your attention because you found more and more you had to hide from him?
That's right.
which of your sponsors get the biggest response from your audience?
One that got a big response that we haven't done very much with for a while was the hot sauce, the Ahua hot sauce. And it still does. People still write a lot to us about that. Bertha's Kitty Boutique got a lot. But then there's a whole cat-owning underground in America, you know. And they would be likely to fasten on to something like that. Powder milk biscuits, I guess, quite a bit. But then, of course, we pushed those harder.
I've always imagined that there must be a segment of your listening population that is thoroughly humorless and takes all of this at face value, thoroughly literally, and, you know, thinks that there are such things as the things you advertise and that, you know, you're, you know, quite serious about everything that you say on the show.
Yeah, there are people who take it seriously, but I don't know that they're humorless. I mean, I think there are humorless people who think that it's all a joke, too. I mean, having a sense of humor is being able to recognize the humor and the seriousness or the pathos in existing in the same thing. I think that the funniest times and the funniest things are when those two get closer together. Not when we're silliest, you know. If we were to sit in here and tell a bunch of, you know, second grade jokes, but when the two come real close together.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean by that. I think a lot of people in radio really cherish the ability to have their listeners never see them, and to have this kind of contact with a lot of spatial separation where you never see each other face to face. But you're one of the few people in radio that kind of has that and kind of doesn't, because sure, there's a lot of listeners who you don't interact with in the same room, but whenever you're on the air for Prairie Home, there's a lot of people out there in the audience with you. And I wonder if you've ever missed that insulation that other radio people have.
Well, you see, I still do a studio show back in Minnesota. It's an early morning radio show like 1,000 others on public stations around, and so I still am able to do that, and I occasionally do what you're doing and have somebody come in, sit down, and I interview them in a studio. So I'm doing both at the same time. But when I started doing this radio show, A Prairie Home Companion, I was writing for a living, and I was writing fiction, which means shutting yourself up all week in a room with a typewriter. And I'll tell you, by the time Saturday rolls around, you feel very gregarious. You want to throw the biggest and loudest party in town. And I started doing this Saturday show just as a way of amusing me and doing something with my friends on a Saturday.
Some people say you're shy. Is that true?
Yeah.
I've always imagined.
Now that you remind me of it, now I feel terribly shy.
Now that
you
mentioned
it. You made me feel terrible.
No, what were the powder milk biscuits are designed for shy people. But it's always been hard for me to imagine you being shy since you're so at ease in front of and in person with a large group on Saturday nights.
Well, when I was up in Boston, I met a fellow who I went to high school with and have not seen since. And I really enjoyed talking with him. And he said he was amazed that I was doing this sort of thing. It was the last thing he ever would have predicted for me. And he's right. But sometimes a person's fear, in my case, the fear of talking to other people, becomes so powerful, and it becomes such a burden to carry, that you have to go straight at it and just go do it. And in fact, do it in the biggest form possible. Just as if a person is frightened of the water, it may not be as good for them just to walk into the water out of the shallows as it may be to climb up on the dock and dive, and not foot first, head first. They may, in doing that, just instantly get rid of a lot of fear that they've been carrying around with them. Not to try and work around it, outsmart themselves, you know, talk themselves out of it, but just go right straight at it. And that was one reason I started doing that radio show. I mean, a private reason, doesn't have anything to do with an audience, oughtn't to concern them at all. But before I stood up and did that show in 1974, I had never acted in any kind of play at any time in my life. I had never I think, given more than about two or three speeches in my life, and always with fear unto death, you know.
But, you know, I think that's part of the reason that the show reaches people so directly, because there's this sense that you bring to it of people shouldering burdens and trying to deal with it, and you deal with it in a way that's very ironic, and you can kind of identify with it and laugh at it at the same time, and you feel like you're not the only person dealing with these strange burdens. Even with names like Our Lady of Perpetual Responsibility mm-hmm. Church, you know, there's the sense that everybody, like you, is walking, I mean, like you, meaning like me, is walking walking around with all these, like, private insecurities or fears or burdens, and that there's something that to be shared in all of it, and also to be laughed at as well as worried about.
Yes, to be laughed at as well as worrying about it. I mean, they're not terrible problems, really. I think for some reason about a group of people who came to a broadcast back in Minnesota, and somebody who was in radio could particularly appreciate this. It was a group of people who happened to be in wheelchairs. And the most convenient place to put them was right down front, where there is room to wheel the chairs in, and they're on a flat piece of the floor there at the World Theater on what used to be the orchestra pit. So they were right down there in the dark. I could see their chairs. I couldn't really see their faces very well. But as we went on into the broadcast and I got into the powder milk biscuit spot, I started to hear these sounds coming from them, wheezing sounds, gasping sounds, in a way, kind of ghastly sounds that I'm sure people might have heard at home if they were listening carefully. And it wasn't until I had talked for a while longer before I realized that they were laughing. But they were suffering from a disease that I think must have been cerebral palsy, and they were expressing laughter. These disabled people were expressing laughter. And I talked to one of the women who had brought them down there after the show. She told me how much they enjoyed it. And I realized that in that world that we share in radio, which is a dark world, we're in the darkness, that these disabilities are forgotten, you see. People at home form an image of me. I form an image of people at home. And we each form an image of ourselves. And I think that those people in the chairs who came to the show maybe felt that they were normal when they listened to it, you know. They didn't feel odd listening to it. Or maybe they figured I was in a wheelchair too.
Yeah, but you were
from
in
listening
kind of
to it on the radio.
You were in a kind of strange spot, weren't you, since their laughter sounded like wheezes and gasps.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say anything to acknowledge what was happening, or
I can't think of anything I could have said.
Yeah, I can't think of anything either.
I can't think of anything I could have said.
Did it come across? Did you listen back to the tapes?
I didn't listen to the tapes. I heard some people had asked about it, had called the radio station about it. There's nothing. What could you do?
I don't know. It's kind of
just sail onward.
Right. I'm talking to Garrison Keillor, if you're just joining us, the creator and, of course, host of Prairie Home Companion. One of the things that you do on the show that I would have thought would be kind of corny, but it works, it really works perfectly, and it actually makes me feel kind of friendly to people I don't know who are listening, is your acknowledgments of people, you know, happy mm-hmm. birthdays to people and saying hello to people at home when you're on the road, or listeners in other part of the country who are tuning in. And that is, to me, a little like the radio that I grew up with, because, of course, the rock and roll DJs would always dedicate, it was different, but they'd always dedicate records to mm-hmm. people and say hello to someone from their boyfriend or their girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you decide to include that in?
We didn't have it for the first few years, and then I just started asking people where they were from before I went on the air so that I could say it on the air. You know, we have people here from Wadena and Wabasso and Duluth and Two Harbors and so on. And then I had them write it out on paper because I couldn't hear all of them as they were shouting names of hometowns out of the theater. I couldn't hear them all. So I had them write it down, and as they started writing them down, they would write their towns, or sometimes they would write something about the towns, or they would ask to say hello to somebody, and it just grew out of that. Now we get a lot of mail every week from people asking us to say hello to their friends and happy birthday and so on. And it is a very mysterious thing to me. Over the years of doing this show, I occasionally feel as if I'm on the outside of it, looking in, that my role in it is real incidental. That I'm there. I don't feel this way all the time, but I feel it sometimes, that I'm there to give people something to focus on, but that in fact the show has much more to do with the audience than it does with what's on stage. And that business about greetings is part of that, that people will want to say hello to members of their family who are scattered across the country. And the appeal of it is not just in my reading the names, but in their knowing that at that same moment in time, their brothers and sisters and parents are listening to the same show in all these different places. And it's like in romantic novels, one device in romantic novels. Remember, if the lovers were separated, they would promise to think of each other at the same time in the day. And it seems to me that it has to do with that. And that sometimes what I do is not real important, not nearly as important to the show as people tuning in order to be in the same imaginative place as other people that know.
We'll hear an example of those greetings and dedications that we were talking about in just a moment. We're listening to an interview with Garrison Keillor, the creator and host of A Prairie Home Companion. And by the way, you can hear that show every Saturday evening from 6 until 8 on WUHY-FM. Coming up in 2 weeks on November 14th, a special edition of A Prairie Home Companion, which was recorded at Clothier Hall on the Swarthmore College campus. And the featured performers on this special Delaware Valley program are Priscilla Herdman, Mick Maloney, Eugene O'Donnell and friends, and WUHY's own Bob Carlin. Well, before we return to the interview that I recorded with Garrison, let's hear another excerpt of A Prairie Home Companion, and this is from the Prairie Home Companion anniversary album.
Well, we have some friends with us tonight from Sweden here tonight, in River Falls, Wisconsin, too, in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and Mankato, and Delaware, Ohio, and Prescott, Wisconsin, down there in the St. Croix, and Platte, South Dakota, and from Crystal, too, and Monticello. And a bunch of you here from Lake Wobegon, I guess. A few of you. Boy, it's been a busy month here for Margaret Haskins Derber, the poet laureate of Lake Wobegon. Boy, she churned out a poem on winter here just this last week. We read it last Saturday night. Sent us another one here this week. Some people have asked me if I think that Margaret Haskins Derber's poems are good poems, and I don't know. They're not like the poems that I write at all. They're my stuff is, I write serious poems and unrhymed and very obscure, so nobody would understand what they mean. I kind of like hers. This is called The Ballad of the Guy Who Came in from the Cold. In northeast Minnesota, what they call the Iron Range, where men are men, and that is that, and some things never change, where winter stays 9 months a year, there is no spring or fall, and it's so cold the mercury cannot be seen at all,
Where you and I, we normal folks, would shiver, shake, and chatter. And if we used an outhouse, we would grow an extra bladder. But even when it's coldest, when our feet would have no feeling, those Iron Rangers get dressed up and go out snowmobiling. Out across the frozen land and make a couple stops at Gino's Lounge and Rudy's Bar for whiskey, beer, and schnapps. And then they go into a shack that's filled with boiling rocks, that's hot enough to sterilize an Iron Ranger's socks. They sit there till they steam out every sin and every foible. Then they jump into a frozen lake and claim that it's enjoyable. But there was one, a shy young man, and although he was Finnish, the joys of winter had for him long started to diminish. He was a Finn, the only Finn, who would not take a sauna. It isn't that I can't, he said, I simply do not wanna. And so he stayed close by a stove for 9 months of the year because he was so sensitive to change of temperature. His friend said, come on, Toivo, let's go out to Sunfish Lake. A Finn who don't take saunas? Why, there must be some mistake. But Toivo said, there's no mistake. I know that I would freeze in water colder than myself, 98.6 degrees. To jump into a frozen lake is not my fondest wish, for just because I am a Finn don't mean that I'm a fish. One night he went to Eveleth to attend the miners' ball. If you have not danced in Eveleth, you've never danced at all. And he met a Finnish beauty there who turned his head around. She was broad of beam, and when she danced, she shook the frozen ground. She took that shy young man in hand and swept him off his feet and bounced him up and down until he learned that polka beat. She was strong as any man. She was as fair as she was wide. And when the dance was over, he asked her to be his bride. She looked him over carefully. She said, you're kind of thin, but you must have some courage if it's true you are a Finn. I ain't particular about men. I am no prima donna, but I would never marry one who would not take a sauna. They got into her pickup, and down the road they drove. And 15 minutes later, they were stoking up the stove. She had a flask of whiskey, they had a couple toots, and went into the shack and got into their birthday suits. She steamed him and she boiled him until his skin turned red. She poured it on until his brains were boiling in his head. To improve his circulation and to soften up his hide, she got a couple birch boughs and she beat him till he cried, oh, couldn't you just love me now? Oh, don't you think you can? She said, it's time to go outside and show you are a man. Straightway, because he loved her so, he thought his heart would break. He jumped right up and out the door and ran down to the lake. And though he paused a moment when he saw the lake was frozen and tried to think just which snowbank his love had put his clothes in, when he thought of his true love, he didn't have to think twice. He just picked up his frozen feet and raced across the ice, and coming to the hole that they had cut there with an axe, putting common sense aside, ignoring all the facts, he leaped. Oh, what a leap. And as he dove below the surface, it thrilled him to his very soul and also made him nervous. And it wasn't just the tingling cold he felt in every limb. He cried, my love, I'm finished. I forgot I cannot swim. She fished him out and stood him up and gave him an embrace that warmed his very heart and made the blood rush to his face. I love you, darling dear, she cried. I love you with all my might. And she drove him to Bawabik, and he married her that night. And they live happily to this day, although they sometimes quarrel. And there, I guess, the story ends, except for this, the moral. Marriage, friends, is not a banquet. Love is no free lunch. You cannot dabble round the edge, but each must take the plunge. Though marriage, like that frozen lake, may sometimes make us colder, it has its pleasures too, as you may find out when you're older.
an excerpt from the Prairie Home Companion anniversary album. You can hear a Prairie Home Companion every Saturday night from 6 until 8 o'clock on WUHY. Well, we've just heard Garrison Keillor reading the work of the poet laureate of Lake Wobegon. Let's return to the interview I recorded with Garrison and find out about his writing.
Were you a writer when you were in high school? Were you like the writer of your high school?
No, I was the secret writer.
No one knew, huh?
Well, yeah, I think they sort of did, but I kept it to myself pretty much. I was a real secret person. But I've been writing since I was a little kid.
What did you start writing about? Because I think it's hard to find your voice in two ways, not only like the voice you're going to write in, but the kinds of things you're going to write about, the kinds of stories you have to tell. I think sometimes like young writers feel this urge to write, but don't really know what it is they want to say.
When I was very small, I wrote quite a few stories about animals. They were not funny animals, you know, animals who talk and put on funny clothes. But they were real animals who were all victimized by people and who had to go off and find a place by themselves. In fact, some of the animals that I wrote about were victimized by people and also ostracized by other animals. And those were very odd stories because there was no possibility of dialogue there. They were sort of shut off from everybody. When I got a little bit older, I tried to write what I thought was sophisticated poetry, you know, sort of disjointed and a series of rather jagged images. But that, in the end, was not very satisfying. And I hit on writing comedy, which I have always been glad that I changed.
Do you save your early writings? Do you still have that around? Like the animal stories?
I've moved so many times. I've in the last 10, 15 years, and every time I move, I lose something. And I've lost a lot of it. I lost a journal that I kept when I was very young, which really breaks my heart, because I would like to be able to go back and look at that now. So I don't have much left of it.
Would you be frightened if you did? I think it's sometimes very frightening to come across stuff that you wrote years ago. Of course, I have good reason to be frightened, I think, when I come across it. It's kind of embarrassing. I don't even
really
want myself to read it when I come across it, yeah.
Oh, no. How could you be embarrassed by anything that you had done in good faith?
It's pretty easy, I think.
Really?
Yeah. I found myself that I wrote, when I was young, the kind of poetry that is just so embarrassing, really. It's the kind of stuff, you know, that you would put down really easily, no.
Why is it embarrassing? Because it isn't somebody else's poetry?
We always wish you were really sophisticated when you were young.
Yes, but when you are
And when you were young and trying to be sophisticated, looking back, it seems really silly.
Yeah, but you're forming your idea of sophistication from what you see of other people. And you're judging yourself against them. Your poetry might not be fashionable, and it might not be, in fact, it might not even be very good, but it might be very good bad poetry.
There you go.
You might have invented some very original style of embarrassingly good, embarrassingly bad poetry.
Do people send you their writing?
Yeah.
What do you do? Do you read it and write back? It's a big responsibility.
If they're not too serious about it, I will read it. But there are dangers in writers reading other writers' stuff before publication. And it really is a much better idea just to put it back in an envelope and send it back to them.
So that's what you do?
I usually do, yeah.
With a note saying that writers shouldn't judge other writers?
No, it has to do with the change in plagiarism laws and in some cases involving charges of plagiarism that I have heard about and editors have warned me about, that there have been some incredible decisions made against writers involving plagiarism from manuscripts that they cannot remember having seen. And it's unfortunate, but plagiarism is the last thing I would want to be accused of after, you know, violent crime.
So you just send it back? Who are the writers you like to read?
I have enjoyed going back now and reading a writer whom I had not dared to read for a while because I was afraid of imitating him, and that is E.B. White, and especially his book entitled One Man's Meat, which he wrote when he left New York to live on his farm in Maine back in the late 1930s. His collected letters is also, I think, a great, great book. And I've been going back and reading that. I'm a little bit late. I'm years behind in my reading. I'm reading books now that probably most people read years ago.
What else?
I've been reading the collected letters of Flannery O'Connor. And I mean to go back and to read her stories again. But again, I'm a little bit afraid of them because they are Southern, they're set in the country and in the small town, and I am afraid that through some complicated process, some detail from one of her stories might come up in a Lake Wobegon monologue years from now, and somebody would tell me about it, and I would truly feel wretched.
Well, you can't sit in a sensory deprivation chamber, though.
No, I don't suppose.
We're listening to an interview that I recorded with Garrison Keillor, the host and creator of A Prairie Home Companion. We'll return to the interview after another word from his sponsor.
This last portion of our show is brought to you by Jack's Auto Repair in Lake Wobegon and by Jack's many programs. We never go on a college campus, but we always like to say a word in behalf of Jack's program for the rehabilitation of the overeducated, the so-called Head Stop program. Head Stop program is a program that was founded back in the 1960s when it was believed by a lot of people that if a little bit of education was good, then more would be better and too much would be just enough. And so people came to specialize in little tiny branches of knowledge and to know more and more about less and less until they were no longer on a branch of knowledge. They were actually out on a little leaf at the end of one twig of knowledge, which, if you are a person of normal weight, is a treacherous place to be. And time to head for the Head Stop program, which tries to get you down out of the tree. I think of people like college presidents, for example. Having just heard from one here who is a fine president, college presidents who are brilliant men and women, brilliant scholars, who became authorities in some little branch of knowledge, say maybe Norwegian epic poetry or elements of Christian parables and miracles in Bantu mythology, and knew more about it than anything else. And then a few committee assignments led to a deanship someplace, and then all of a sudden they became a college president. And suddenly they were like the mayor of a small town and concerned mainly with maintenance and with plumbing and with parking and with feeding the multitudes, sometimes with only a few loaves and fishes, so that instead of studying miracles, they had to make them. All I mean to say is that life has surprises for all of us, including the highly educated, because education is no preparation for life. It is something that we do for itself and for its own beauty, like going to a concert of Mozart quartets. But life is not like those quartets, and you should be prepared for a little bump when you come out of the hall. And the same happens when you get out of college. And Jack's program can do a little bit something for you. At least it can help you learn how to talk to people who are less intelligent than yourself, which you ought to learn how to do because there are so many of them. The program for the rehabilitation of the overeducated from Jack's Auto Repair All Tracks to lead to Jack's, where the bright flashing lights show you the way to complete satisfaction. Speaking of colleges, we want to say hello to Phil, Sue, Jim, Bev, Ann, Johnny, and the City of Cows, Colleges, and Contentment, which is Northfield, Minnesota. And hello to all the family back home in Iowa City, Iowa, from Sue and Benson. Also note that Benson's cat had 4 kittens last month, and we need homes for them. Seeing step up towards the stage after the show if you're interested.
That was an excerpt of a special edition of A Prairie Home Companion, recorded 2 weeks ago in the Delaware Valley at Swarthmore College. And you can hear this special program in 2 weeks, Saturday night, November 14th, from 6 until 8. And there will be a number of Delaware Valley performers on the special program, Priscilla Herdman, Mick Maloney, Eugene O'Donnell and friends, and Bob Carlin. Well, let's return to the interview that I recorded when Garrison Keillor visited Philadelphia, and let's find out if he thinks success will change the show.
You must be getting, like, offers now. I mean, for instance, I bet someone has suggested putting Prairie Home on TV, because when something gets, you know, successful, one of the signs of that success is offers to put it on TV, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would it translate? Would you be interested in something like that?
I don't think so, but I'm not interested. I'm not particularly interested right now. Because for one thing, whenever somebody comes and makes me an offer, I like to look them in the eye and see what kind of person they are. I mean, good people can come to you with terrible ideas, but when the idea comes from somebody who is kind of smarmy and kind of a jerk, you know, then why even bother thinking about it? That's a direct answer.
Uh-huh. Would you ever want to move from Minnesota? Could you see yourself in, like, New York or Los Angeles, a place like that?
I really can't, for a lot of reasons, and the simplest reason is that I'm divorced and my son lives with his mother, and he's 12 years old, and I would hate to miss out on bringing him up. And if I moved someplace else, I would become an absentee parent. That just isn't something I'd consider being.
Yeah. I bet people have said to you, well, the show's national, you can move now. You can
Can't.
Right.
Can't. I mean, I only have one kid.
Yeah.
You know?
You're working on a novel too, right?
I've done a lot of work on a novel. I'm not working on it now and haven't for about a year and a half. It's sitting in a cardboard box. It's under a bed in the front bedroom. And I'm sure I'm going to finish it someday. But then a lot of people have novels in boxes sitting around, so that's not... That's no mark of distinction.
There's one last thing I'm wondering. When the stories that you tell on Prairie Home Companion, are they written out first? Are they, like, done at the typewriter, or are they done just in your head?
I write because I've always written. Really, writing, sitting at a typewriter or sitting with a piece of paper is my way of thinking, you know? I can't sit at a window and look out and think in any sort of organized way. So I sit down every week and I write a lot. And I write about Lake Wobegon and I write about Powdermilk Biscuits, but I don't think of them as scripts. I don't write them as scripts. I simply want to have a lot in my head so that I can go out and do the show whether I feel inspired on a Saturday or semi-inspired or whether I feel dull and stupid. I never take anything out on stage with me to read from unless I have written a script for myself and for other people to do. So I write, but I write as a way of committing things to memory and storing up things. And then when I'm done with them, they go into a box. I don't look at them again.
There's a couple more things I worry about, and then we'll have to go because we really are running out of time. But when you are feeling kind of, say, blue one day or just not as lively as you want to be, how do you get around that on the air? Do you drink a lot of coffee or what? And how do you deal with burnout also?
Well, I haven't had to deal with burnout because I'm not, I don't feel burnt. I feel as if, I feel that we've been pursuing an idea since 1974, which is, since it is radio, is something that can't be written down, but is a sound that a person has in their mind, you know, the of a sort of show you would like to do. And we're still pursuing that after 7 years. We were getting slightly closer. And I'm not tired of trying. There are particular Saturdays when I am real tired. But you can do it. It can be done. There's no reason you can't do it. And especially when you go down to the theater and you see the people are in there and they've paid their money and they're on hand.
Okay. Well, I enjoy your show very much and it's really great to be able to talk to you. Thanks for being
Thanks
here.
For having me.
Oh, has your family tried and buttermilk? Has your family tried them buttermilk? Well, if your family's tried them, you know you satisfied them. They're the real hot item, buttermilk. They're the real hot item, buttermilk. Yes, buttermilk. Biscuits!
You can hear A Prairie Home Companion every Saturday night on WUHY from 6 until 8 o'clock. Garrison Keillor, the host and creator of Prairie Home Companion, who we just heard from, visited Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago. When he took the show on the road, they visited three cities, and one of them was Philadelphia. They recorded a special broadcast at Clothier Hall in Swarthmore College. And if you'd like to hear it, we'll be featuring that program Saturday evening, November 14th, from 6 until 8, so that's coming up in 2 weeks. If you want to try some of Garrison's writing, he does have a piece in this current edition of The New Yorker. Well, that about does it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. Let me tell you what's happening Monday afternoon. At 2 o'clock, my guest will be Joe Foxworth, who has written a couple of books about women in executive positions. Her new book is called Wising Up. Then we'll be joined by Dr. Herbert Freudenberger, who's a psychologist who's written a lot about burnout, which is a problem you may be very well familiar with. At 2:45, my guest will be Moorhead Kennedy, who was a hostage in Vietnam. At 3:30, Dan Luskin, Off the Wall, our review of the Literary Press. And at 3:40, Judy Stein reviews museum and gallery shows around town. At 4 o'clock, John Johnson and the Musical Stage, Part 3 of Black Broadway. And the subject will be Hot Chocolates. So that's coming up Monday at 4, and I hope you can join us then. Contributing to this afternoon's Fresh Air was Bill Van Wert, and the technical director was Rob Richens. The production assistant is Maeve McGoran. The associate producer is Danny Miller. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a very good evening. If you have any questions or comments about the show, drop us a line at WUHY, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, 19106. Have a great weekend. Happy Halloween. This is WUHY FM in Philadelphia.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg.
And I'm Sanford Unger, with All Things Considered. from the castle. The shade grew denser and the air more filled with brooding fear, so that I ran frantically back, lest I lose my way in a labyrinth of nighted silence.
The words were written by H.P. Lovecraft, who knew more about evil than most. He told what he knew in a series of stories based on his dreams, memories, and introspections. What better way to spend the night before Halloween than listening to Lovecraft on All Things Considered?
Also tonight, these stories, maybe the budget won't balance by 1984.
White House Chief of Staff James Baker on taxes of various kinds.
The Attorney General wants to restrict what federal courts can do.
And we ask how that can be done.
Used car dealers have to tell you what you're buying.
But the Congress might change that ruling.
The latest movie from General Motors.
The latest ads from local hospitals.
A book of new essays about life in the garden.
And euphemisms, a nice way to convey nasty realities.
That and more tonight in All Things Considered. First, Mary Beth Bowen has this news.
Treasury Secretary Donald Regan said today that it's not likely that the Reagan administration can balance the budget by 1984. That's something President Reagan has promised repeatedly. Regan told the Senate Budget Committee that it's possible but not probable. He also said the Treasury Department may have to borrow $420 million this year.
This year, Treasury has to refinance $350 billion and raise, I don't know, depends upon what the deficit will be, plus this off-budget money. Let's suppose that the combination puts us in the $80 or $90 billion area. That means we're going to have to raise $420 billion at Treasury to supply this. I suspect that this might tend to keep interest rates high, which would be counterproductive.
Regan says the administration is now revising its economic outlook and will